Hi, I'm Bex Dillon and welcome to this podcast, Conversations on Faith and Equality. In this podcast, I got to interview Sue Hopkinson. Now, I'd been wanting to interview Sue for a while. As soon as I spoke to her on the phone, I thought, this person is amazing. I really want to have her on the podcast. And the reason I spoke to her is because she is the mum of Alex Hopkinson, who was on a few podcasts ago with, he's part of the L'Arche community. I interviewed him and his key worker from L'Arche. And in the build-up, I just spoke to his mum, Sue, about to find out a bit more about Alex, and realised that she actually has trained in working with children with additional needs before she even had Alex, and Alex is 26. So she's really ridden this journey of working with kids with autism and then raising a child with autism. And I just found her really inspiring, the way that she's made Alex's life so full of different things and activities, and she's very joyful and laughs all the time. And when I spoke to her, I thought, this is sort of one of those moments that sometimes, kind of doing this podcast, I feel like people are saying, oh, you should interview this person because they're well known, or you interview this person who's well known. But actually, I find that sometimes the people who are the most inspiring are the ones that they're not famous, they're not getting any recognition for who they are, what they do, but the way that they live their lives every day is really inspiring, and Sue is one of those people. So I hope you enjoy listening to her and hearing a bit more about her. Here we go. Thank you so much, Sue. I'm so happy to have you on it. I think when I spoke to you when I was sort of preparing to interview Alex, I was just so struck by what an amazing mum you are and have been, and in just like the life that Alex has, like obviously the strong bond and connection that you have, but like the amount of activities he has in his life, of like dance, drama, choir, tennis, like everything.
Everything.
And I just thought, you know, knowing lots of people also who are, because I've got small children, and people who are sort of starting to find out that their children have got different syndromes or disabilities, and sort of seeing the start of their journey and thinking, actually, to hear from someone like you who's gone through it and obviously done it so well, just like how to, like, to find out how you've done it, how you've made a life like that, and to sort of just learn from you what it's been like as well, and how people can support people who go through that, who parent children with additional kind of needs. So I thought maybe we could just start with, because Alex is 26, isn't he? So start with kind of what happened 26 years ago and what this sort of the start of the journey's been for you.
26 years ago, I was teaching at a school for children with autism. And my career has been entirely in that field or related to autism. And apart from a break when I left teaching to solely concentrate on Alex and the difficulties that he was having, I've always worked within special needs. So it was an interesting time, a very interesting first few years.
And even then, was there like a lot of knowledge and understanding of autism and special needs?
I started teaching in 1978, when it was a very different understanding of autism. It's been around a long, long time, you know, since the 1940s. And before then, it's just been evidenced since the 1940s. And it was very specific and very, you had to have these 5 points. And if you didn't have those 5 points, you couldn't be autistic. Whereas now we have something called a spectrum, which is very broad and includes a whole variety of other traits and disability, you know, different component parts. So it's been a very interesting journey, that sort of journey of discovering autism. So not just from a work perspective, but from a parental perspective. And I know there are things that I've, advice that I've offered parents as a professional, that as a parent, I'd be challenging myself. Like, she doesn't know what she's talking about. You need to be walking in my shoes. You need to be living it. And sometimes being that professional person, you don't have that deep understanding of what life is like. So my journey was that, although all of my friends and my professional friends could see that Alex wasn't developing as other young children, young babies might do, they felt that I was being a little anxious. And we went down different routes because he had other medical problems as well. And looking back, his biggest difficulty was he had some huge sensory difficulties, which meant I couldn't dress him, I couldn't bath him, I couldn't hold him, touch him, cuddle him, comfort him. And
just because he just didn't
like... He was so tactile defensive, he would just bite me.
How would you actually do that? Like, I mean, every morning, surely you had to still... dressing.
Yeah,
how would you...
It was always a battle. He couldn't bear his feet to touch the ground, so he couldn't walk.
Oh wow! So did he walk quite late?
Yes, and so he was in a. We started having profession. My consultant community paediatrician was actually a professional colleague of mine, who picked us up, and we went through initially through neurology because he was having lapses. So we weren't saying he was having seizures, but he was certainly losing balance and falling from kneeling. And so that's where the journey began at about 18 months. Mm. But he wasn't diagnosed until he was about 3 and a half, which... I'm very fortunate. It's quite early, but I knew my job. I knew early years, and I knew early autism, and for part of it, it felt like, you know, the story of the emperor and the new clothes.
Yeah,
it was like, am I the only person who can see this? Can nobody else see what this little boy is like?
Well, because initially, were they saying no?
Yes. Yeah. There were. Yeah. It was like, oh, you're imagining. No, I'm not imagining. My educational psychologist at one point said, well, of course you'd want him to be autistic, wouldn't you? Would I? Yeah. Of all the things in the world, would I want my son to be autistic? Because I know what it looks like further down the line.
That's such a funny thing to say. Yeah.
I know, not helpful at all. So I was desperate, absolutely desperate for a specialist nursery, because he needed to have some very, very clear early intervention or tech, you know, programs of speech and language therapy. He didn't really speak. I, because of my background, I'd introduced signs and symbols. And that's what I, you know, that's what I did in my main job. So that's what I did at home. And I wanted speech and language therapy. I wanted, we were doing physiotherapy and occupational therapy because at that time we were able to access occupational therapy, but then they drew a line underneath. So later on, those parents with children with similar difficulties on the sensory integration dysfunction side weren't able to access occupational therapy because there were just too many of them and they couldn't deal with them all. So I fought to get a statement, and I fought to get Alex into a specialist nursery.
Because although I've actually don't even know how, like at that stage, didn't even know that there are specialist nurseries. So are there a lot of them? There can't be...
that many? It's not there now. They got rid of it.
Oh, really?
Because I worked. So when Alex was born, I was class teaching and part-time and then doing something called outreach where I worked in mainstream schools supporting children with special needs, some with statements, some without. So specialist nursery, we had about five standalone nurseries and one specialist nursery. But Nottingham City and County had an understanding that children should be in mainstream schools wherever possible. Mm. And so the specialist nursery was closed.
Do you think that was a good thing? Do you think that's better?
No, not at all. No, a lot of, you know, so many children over the years could have had that amazing start. I mean, Alex went into a mainstream school after nursery, so we went in reception to his local mainstream school. He went in with full-time support because he was a wild, wild child who needed 2-to-1 at times. He was very challenging behaviourally and, yeah, he was very challenging.
But did that work in mainstream school?
Sorry?
Did that work in mainstream school? He was able to kind of...
It sort of did to begin with, because actually it was one of the schools that I was supporting as a professional. I'm not quite sure how ethical that was, but that's how it worked. You know, that's how it worked. It was one of my schools. And I had friends there because I'd built up a relationship over the past years being their outreach teacher, their support service teacher. So it worked while ever the curriculum wasn't as demanding. Once that curriculum, you know, this is a young man who now at 26 doesn't really have functional reading and writing skills. So when they're banging away with reception level words and he's like, stop, you know, he's a look and say person. He doesn't have phonic word building skills and he never, you know, he probably never will. So I asked for his place in a special school. And I looked at the school where I'd been, where I taught, or I had been teaching, because I'd then left that school and was working for a central service. And I looked in Lincolnshire. And so I didn't just look at one place, but Alex actually took up a place at the school that I taught at, but wasn't teaching at that time. And that worked. That was a school just for children with autism.
Okay.
And that worked well. He went there at 10. So he'd gone into mainstream at 5. And then he left in year 5 before the pressure of SATs, because he would never have coped with that. Mm. And he had a lovely time at Rose Hill until he got to about 15. And then he really struggled with some of the other students' behaviours. Because it was a school full of autistic children. and I started to realise that it was really important that Alex began to have friendships with people who weren't just autistic, to have friendships with people with a wide range of disabilities, which is when we start. So we started off at Special Olympics. We'd always done the swimming group, but that was an autism swimming group. So I started exploring activities and clubs where Alex might be able to mix with different group of people. And at 16, I asked for him to leave that school and go to a different school, which was the school that I was teaching at.
It's amazing that you had that sort of background and experience to therefore like understand.
Yeah,
I feel like for a lot of but people,
it's or every step along the way has been a battle. Mm. Nothing was ever easy because of my background. In fact, at some point, it was probably harder. Mm. But I, you know, my heart goes out to those parents and families who don't have knowledge and understanding and awareness and experience of what might be available out there, it must be so, so hard. But from when Alex was 18 months old, I became involved in a parent support group, which I'm now chair of trustees for this support group. So all those years later, I'm still passionate about parents supporting other parents with input from different professionals. And we're now a parent carers forum. So they're national, they're all over the country. But when we started out, we're just a little parent support group.
Yeah, because that was one of the things I was going to ask is, you know, did you feel supported? Because you were doing it on your own. And
I couldn't have done, because there was always a parent there who you could say, have you heard about, or do you know about? And like even now, I've just been put in touch with two families here in Nottingham, and one early years and one a little bit older, just because, you know, and we sat on Saturday night at tennis and some new families joined. And I said, oh, did you know about? He said, no, I don't know about that. And do you know about this? No, I don't know about that. And parents are really, really good at sharing, especially special needs parents. Like, they don't keep it to themselves. They like to share.
And did you feel like other parents or other people around you were also able to support you? Obviously, you kind of, because of your background, you knew a lot of people who did have a good understanding of autism. Mm. But what about other people who didn't, maybe who were kind of friends or family that were close to you? Were they able to support you?
Yeah, I mean, my parents, when they were both alive, were amazing with Alex. And as a single parent, I mean, when I went back to work, I was still breastfeeding because I was totally on my own. Yeah. And I used to run home at lunchtime, and he was so ill as a child, as a young child. My parents used to do the daytime at the hospital, and then I used to go and sleep at the hospital every night. Wow. And then go to work in the morning. Yeah. And over the years, the hardest thing I've had to cope with, I think, is sleep deprivation. Alex never slept. He did sleep, but not for longer than a 2-hour stretch. Oh, so it was broken sleep throughout the night, and we used to do the musical beds where he'd get out, get into mine, he'd go to sleep, then I'd get out and get into his, and then he'd wake up and I wasn't there, and then he'd get out and follow me. Now I know he's awake, but he just doesn't have to tell me.
But I mean, that is one of the hardest things to cope with, I think, is sleep deprivation.
Absolutely. And it's cumulative as well, so over a period of time you just keep going and going and going, and the point when I left teaching was a point when I felt my colleagues weren't supporting me. My parents, my friends and parents were, my colleagues weren't. So I'm working a full-time job with Alex. I'm doing all the training for the schools after school. Can you set up a parent support group in the evening? Oh, I'll see if I can do it. And I'm doing a distance learning master's degree in autism with no study time.
Wow.
And you just think, I can't do that. And I woke up one day and I couldn't function anymore. And I, for Alex's sake, I pretended to go to work every day.
But how did you cope in that time? I mean, even just that, it just sounds so full on. What kind of kept you going?
What kept me going? He kept me going. You know, I'm doing it for him. And sometimes you forget how hard things were and where you came from and the journey that you've been on. You know, I've taken him on holidays, and it's like day one. Day two, I'm looking to get us home because I can't actually cope with him. You know, and I'm the first to put my hand up and say, I can't cope. I can't do it. And I think that's hard. It's hard to admit that, and especially for me as a, you know, people think I know what I'm doing. I mean, sometimes I do, but sometimes I don't. Sometimes I don't know what I'm doing, and you just fly by the seat of your pants and hope for the best. Just wing it. But he kept me going. I had to for him. It's like, you know, when people say, oh, you know, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, it's like, because I have to. Mm. I have to keep going because my parents are both deceased. I have a sister, but she has her own family and responsibilities within that family. So there's just Alex and myself. And I have to keep going. Yeah. And, you know, I've sort of made plans-ish. And for a long time, I couldn't think about the future. Even before I was diagnosed with breast cancer, I couldn't think about the future. I found it very... And I'm not on my own. A lot of parents really struggle with that, coming to terms with what does the future look like for them without me. Mm. I think the sort of tipping point in the last couple of years with my health and also the pandemic, it's like I've been more acutely aware of how fragile my own mental health is and acknowledge that sometimes I just need to just have a minute, have a moment.
Do you still have that support? I mean, now if you're kind of on the board, you're providing support to other people, but do you have the support for yourself? Because that's still...
Yes, yeah. There are long-term friendships and most of those friends, my close friends, are people who initially were people who worked with Alex, who became my friend and my rod and my support, and they're always there. And, you know, they all have their own families and things to deal with, but I know that if there was an emergency, they would be there. Mm. If anything happened, they'd be there. And we have our church group. So we've got church group and we've got L'Arche as well. And obviously there are people within that. I feel very well supported because they're people who understand. So they're families with young adults, older adults in some cases, with additional needs. And we support each other.
Mm. And for people who know, who maybe don't have children with additional needs themselves, but know people, like, how would you say they should be supporting the people who have got children with autism?
Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Because I still think that's like, oh, well, I won't know what to do or won't know what to say. And it's like, I won't know how to, you know, it's just they're people. They're people first. And whatever disabilities they have, they're still people first. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that. You know, some of Alex's friends are amazing young people, amazing. And, you know, they bring joy and, yeah, they just bring a different dimension to life. And sometimes it's uncomplicated, it's undemanding. And it's honest, and yeah, it's lovely.
Do you feel like over these years you've seen that there are things where society needs to change in the way that it does relate to people with disability?
Yeah, even now, I have a huge thing about hidden disability, and I've. You know, challenged people in the past, but we were at the campsite that we've been going to since Alex was a baby. It's in Norfolk, and my sister and I used to both have caravans there, and we'd just remove ourselves there because she was a teacher and so was I. She got her three children, I've got Alex, and we'd just spend the summer there because her husband would be working. Like, why be there? You know, why be at home when you could be at the seaside? So. When he was small, when he was a baby, he had a bath in a bucket. When he got a bit bigger, he was in the sink. And I asked this new sight person, could I have a key for the disabled shower? And he stood there. He says, is it for you? And I said, no, it's for my son. And he looked him up and down. And I just said to him, he's not in a wheelchair because it's a hidden disability. That's all I said. Because, you know, it's that perception that that society has that unless you're in a wheelchair, you're not disabled. Mm. And and a lot of the parents, I think that's one thing that they do find. And people judge. People are very, very quick to judge. You know, that awful behaviour. I mean, I've been the parent with the screaming child at the checkout. And I've been dragging him along the floor. I've been putting the things in the shopping trolley. He's been chucking them out and grabbing people as they were.
I've done that with my children. I think every parent's done that, haven't they?
Every parent, absolutely. You know, and as time went on, we'd go with he'd have his board and he'd have his symbols on there, and then we'd be velcroing the things and let's look for the apple, stick that one on there, put it in the trolley, and we might get six things in a trolley, and it's like, yeah, that's a result, that's yeah. And then when he introduced online shopping, it's like, thank you very much.
It's amazing that it seems like he has so many different people in his life,
yeah.
With Sean and the Larsh community,
yeah, and then all yeah, the other and he's things. Got his, all his different clubs and activities. But there's a lot of crossover. So choir and his day services and tennis and badminton and cricket. So all the activities, there will be people from either Larsh or from church or from a day service who are doing other activities. So there's lots and lots of community in that sort of broader sense of the word, lots of community linking, which he loves.
Is that normal or is that just what you have managed to create?
Well, yeah. When I was teaching, when Alex was... I think he was still in a mainstream school. I was class-based, part-time, and I'm writing, we used to do a home and school diary, and I'm writing the home and school, you know, what we've done today, and da-da-da-da-da. And I just became aware that the reply was always exactly the same. Came home, had his tea, went on the whatever it was at the time, Xbox, PlayStation, whatever. Had a bath, went to bed. And I thought, this is not the life I want for Alex. There has to be, you know, there has to be something in his life. There has to be activities and people and community and more than just coming home, having your tea, watching a bit of telly and playing on your computer and going to bed. And there are an awful lot of people whose life is, are people without disabilities, yeah. Whose life is that. It's not just...
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's probably a very normal description, you know, of a lot of people's lives. School or work, yes. Go home, play a computer game and go to bed.
And go to bed, yes. Or wake up in the middle of the night and play a computer
game. Yeah.
But yes, I just became aware that's not, I mean, I worry that there's too much and that, you know, if he is to move into supported living, that's not sustainable because nobody's going to be able to get into all of these things, which is why we've been doing some travel training. And it's a hard one because he'll say to me, can I come home on the bus tonight? And it's like, no, because it's dark. Mm. And it's not safe, but I can't tell him that, so I just say, oh, you know, it's just easier for mummy to come and fetch you. But he, you know, in the daytime he'll go tomorrow, he'll go to the same place and I take him to the tram terminus and he sits on the same seat because he likes the same seat. So he sits on the same seat on the tram and then he gets off at the hospital, walks down the steps to the next level through the hospital and to his day service, which is just at the back of the hospital. And he walks to the shop in the morning. We've moved, so he had to practice with him crossing a new road and looking for, you know, making sure that it's safe to cross. And half the time he's not paying attention, but, you know, I have to give him an element of independence. Mm. And going to fetch the paper in the morning is one of those things.
And is, he does. Is that, do you think, for a lot of people who would have kind of children similar to Alex, to have that sort of level of independence would be quite unusual? Would most, like, yeah. Well, it seems like Alex is quite unusual because of you and because of him, but what would other, you know, how do, would other parents be doing?
Yeah, I mean, you can't imagine what anxiety, you know, even for me, because people say, well, he travels independently, and it's like, the anxiety never goes away. My anxiety about being out there, you know, if the tram breaks down, will he be able to cope? Mm. And would you know, and you just, you'd never do anything. You'd never go anywhere and you'd never do anything. And sometimes you've just got to stop and think, you know, have I done a good job? He's got his mobile with him. He knows he can ring me. And the day that he didn't ring me was the day that I'd given him his phone and I hadn't checked that it was charged. And it wasn't charged. Oh. So he came home and I said to him, you were meant to ring me when you got on the bus. And he said, ah. And I said, what? And he said, there was a problem. And what problem was that? And he said, it wouldn't work. And I looked at it and I said, that's not your problem. That's not your fault. That's my fault. I said, I must check that the phone is charged and working when I give you the phone in the morning.
How have you found, like, the kind of church? Obviously, Sean's been an amazing example, but how have you found the kind of church, and Lars as well? Have you found the kind of church as, like, another community? Has that been a sort of positive thing?
Absolutely, because they... So Alex knew quite a few of the Lars friends before he joined Lars.
Oh, wow.
So that he was, so we'd already been in, so a couple of the tennis players, and because of day services and other things, the choir and other activities that he does. And at first it was very much an Alex thing. I was not part of it at all. And I found that quite hard because I needed to feel included as well. He would do the plan, shop, cook and eat thing as the group, but then once a month we'd have a together night. And they made a point of saying, oh, Mum's coming to that. Mum's invited to that. Otherwise, he wouldn't have me there. Alex likes to keep things separate when he can. Not always, but often. And he accepts that I'm there and he's okay with that. Mm. But initially, it was, oh, Lars is mine. It's not yours. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. So, and they're my family as well as Alex's family. And they are like family.
Mm, that's an amazing thing to have. That how they are, Lars as a community, seems like an amazing way to be.
Yeah,
what,
definitely.
For like other churches or communities where that are not Lars, but hopefully are diverse, because every church should be diverse. How should they be? What do churches need to do in order to make it an inclusive, welcoming environment?
Well, our church, our Sunday church that we go to, and it's been a very hit and miss sort of year.
Yeah.
And Alex has lost momentum because he hadn't been able, he's not coped with church on Zoom. He did for the first few, but then after that, it had lost him. He needs to be with people. So we were at church on Sunday, it was one where the children were still there. They haven't gone off to Sunday school, and we're very flexible. Our church is, you know, we've got some adults who might struggle, but it's not a problem. It's not a problem if they're noisy. It's not a problem if they're struggling to cope with what's happening. But mostly, I mean, I'm sure he doesn't understand all of what, you know, especially the talking bit, but he loves the singing bit. And he doesn't know any of the songs, but he loves it. And I would like to think that all of the groups that we're part of are welcoming and inclusive and accepting, because nobody wants to go along to something and feel that they're standing out.
How do you make sure the group doesn't do that?
I think because most of us are friends of or parents of, or because of that sort of we're mixing with a wide range of people with a whole range of disabilities, and we don't judge. Whereas I still think we live in a society where people do judge and sometimes find, and I don't know how we move forward on that. As you know, when you're a parent and you feel excluded, and there are an awful lot of parents out there who do, you know, the exclusion bit starts at school, doesn't it? When your child's not quite fitting in.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, what happens? How does that start?
I think when if you've got child in mainstream, and your child's not the one who's being invited,
and like play dates and parties.
Yeah. Although we were lucky, and because I worked in the school, so and my next door but one neighbour, her son was at the school. She was senior nurse on neonatal, and her son had Asperger's, and her younger son, who was at school with mine, was certainly on the spectrum, but that was perhaps not evident when he was younger. We were very lucky in that we were invited. So as well as Alex's special nursery, he also went to a private nursery because I needed the early morning and the late nights covered while I was still at work. And so we had friends. They were a very, very inclusive nursery, private nursery. And we were always included, but I know that's not always the case. And, you know, sometimes when you speak to parents and nobody wanted to play with him, nobody wanted to, you know, invite him round, and it's hard. Mm. And I don't think it gets any easier as they get older, which is, you know, understandable if they develop interests that don't involve other people. Whereas Alex, it's always been about the people. Obsessed, I won't say obsessed, he's always been really, really interested in interacting with grown-ups. He's not interested in the children. It would be the parents, the mum and the dad, and the aunt. Yeah, it would always be the grown-ups. Grown-ups.
Do you think are there things that you've seen or things that you think, like, people just really should not do that? That's, like, some of the worst ways to make people feel excluded or kind of not welcome.
I mean, you know, there's all sorts of examples that come to light or that you think about, you know, especially when someone addresses the adult and not the young person, especially when they get older. You know, it's like having the conversation with mum or dad or carer, not with the young person themselves. You know, they have got a voice. They might not be able to use it very well, but they have got a voice, and we should acknowledge that.
Part of what you're saying is it actually is relationship, isn't it? Because if you know people or you know families who have children with autism, or you know someone who has it, then your understanding and your ability to engage and connect and care for them changes. It's sort of like every issue, I feel like, is the thing that I've talked about all the way through on this podcast. If you don't know anyone and you don't have any connection with people that are different from you, there's this sort of like fear and foreignness about it that stops connections. And it's just kind of working out how to overcome that across sort of differences and through relationship, really, that will change people's, I guess, kind of understanding and perspective.
It was interesting, last week's press brought two new diagnoses, and you just think, that's wonderful, but is it ever so helpful? I don't know. One was Paddy McGuinness's wife, and they've got three children who all have autism. His wife's just been diagnosed. And then the other one is, she was on Celebrity MasterChef, Melanie Sykes. She's just been diagnosed.
Oh, really? Wow.
And you just think, oh, wow. Yes, that's brilliant. But is it? And it's that thing about girls, you know, and I do, having seen how girls and boys develop, I think girls have masking skills that far go beyond what boys would be able to tolerate. So they have really, really good ability to mask their difficulties as they progress through sort of teenage years, which is why I think diagnosis for girls is much later than one might expect for, you know, compared to boys. So, but yes, all sorts of people all over the media.
Do you think that's because, like, the spectrum is also, before it was a bit more black and white, now it's
it's
broader.
Broad. Absolutely.
And who's included in it.
Yeah. So, it's not a bad thing, but sort of thinking how people might view that, it's like, I might be. I mean, I've often thought about myself. It's too late now.
One of the questions I always ask people is what they think the greatest inequality they see in the world is. So I wonder what you think from things that you've seen, what you would think the greatest inequality there is.
For people on the autism spectrum?
Well, no, in anything, but I guess...
anything.
That it could be that because of your experience with work and Alex, but anything, really.
Anything. I think it's the inequality of the haves and the have-nots. And it's, you know, it's the world that we live in. And how we would ever change that, I don't know. I really don't know. And it's a strange world at the moment, sort of we're not post-pandemic at all, are we? We're still, especially most of Europe's now going back into lockdown. It's still a bit scary. But yes, it's... sort of, you know, you can say, oh, world peace and stuff like that, but it's the inequalities of the world that we live in. And, you know, people want, whereas I think, you know, there are things that I want, but there are things that I need. You know, the rest of it is, I was looking around today thinking, I could still just walk out of this house. You know, I've got rid of so much stuff over the years and I still have a house full of stuff. But I think when you have that sort of wake-up call of health, it's like, everything that you have is totally irrelevant. It's not important because you can't take anything with you. And the most important thing is what you have now. And that's your, you know, family, friends, and everything else is incidental.
And what would you say to people who say, you know, they've got like young children and their children have just been diagnosed with autism or with some sort of learning disability? What would you say?
One of the people that she mentioned something to me yesterday at church, and about her grandson, who's coming up to going into school. And I over the years, I've tried to get rid of as much as possible, but I have a core library, and I pulled them off the shelf this morning, this afternoon, and I thought, oh, that is such a good book. And these are all early years, and like some of them became my, I mean, as a professional, they're all good books, but God, as a parent, it's like, oh yeah, that's really, really, really helpful. So if you want me to write you a list of what?
Yeah, I would actually. I think it's always helpful to have, then I can put it in the notes of the podcast and then people can
go to them. I think there's 9 titles on there, just the odd 9 books.
Okay. are there other things other than reading books? Are there other things you would say to people?
Talk to parents, talk to other parents, find a support group. The Down syndrome support groups are so good. Well, they are here in Nottingham, and we do have different autism groups. And you might not find a perfect match straight away. You know, I don't like the people in that one. No, it's fine. You know, but your people will be out there in a different group, and you'll gel. Because I think as parents and carers, we can learn so much from other parents and carers. And as I think I said earlier, you know, we share. That's what parents do. We share things. We don't keep them to ourselves. We share. Yeah.
That's so good. Love that. Thank you so much, Sue. Thank you for doing it. It's really great to have you. Thank you for listening to this podcast conversation on faith and equality and this episode with Sue Hopkinson. Hope you've enjoyed hearing from her and a little bit more about her and her life. Now, Sue mentioned some books. I'm going to try and put them in the notes. But if you have any other questions, please use the email that I have, which is faithandequalitypodcast@gmail.com. And please share these podcasts. Please leave a review, give some feedback. Love to hear your thoughts. And send it to a friend. Thanks for listening.